My name's Ian Harvey, and I'm a comic and an actor and a writer.
Today on the podcast, we're taking the whole episode and talking with Ian Harvey. This is another one of those episodes where the conversation just seemed to be very natural and very fun, and it felt wrong to try and edit it up into something other than what it was. And I really appreciated the conversation I had with Ian, so I wanted to share that with you. So, welcome to the CISO C Show. I'm Andrew Steven.
I think how I wanted to start is maybe, do you remember, was there like a specific moment or was it like a culmination of a lot of small things that got you interested in comedy?
It was a couple of things. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with watching like Laugh-In, Hee Haw, and Carol Burnett Show and Flip Wilson and the Dean Martin roast. And I always thought that all of those things were really funny as a kid. And my cousins and I would put on plays for our parents and our relatives. And I always came out at the intermission and did a comedy routine, which was absolutely horrible. It was always horrible. I wrote my own material.
Oh, so it wasn't like you were quoting someone else's jokes or something like that?
No, I tried that too, but that was also horrible. But yeah. I wrote some of my own material, and actually my middle brother, Jeff, still teases me and remembers one of my jokes and will occasionally bring it up to me, which was, I knew that jokes had to have a punchline, but yeah. I didn't understand joke structure at all. So the joke was, what happens when you open the refrigerator door?
What does happen when you open the refrigerator?
You find Bobby Orr. And here, now that is not a joke. I realize that.
Is that a real person?
He's a real person. Okay. He was a hockey star on the Boston Bruins years ago. And he was popular at the time. So I was trying to do like pop culture joke. but it was absolutely horrible.
It just rhymed.
It was horrible. All it did was rhyme. And so I didn't really understand joke structure, but I knew that watching comics, like I knew that there was da 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 da. Da 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 da, yeah. And that's all I did. I made a rhyme.
When I was younger, I remember. It still brings shame and embarrassment to me to this day. But I was with my brothers. I was like, "Why did the chicken cross the road? To spill milk on you?" And I poured my glass of milk all over my brother. And
yeah. I mean, you know what? It's it was for me probably it was like the beginning of which I never really followed up on, which was, you know, an absurd kind of comedy, yeah. You know, which exists and can work really well. But mine, I didn't follow that path.
Yeah, mine was like the Gallagher style, I guess.
Yeah, just
make it messy.
Which, you know, funny, fast forward to later in life when I first took my first comedy writing course. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really about performance, although we did rip and read in the class. We would, you know, share our ideas, and in the end of this 7-week class, we did an 8-week performance, and it was great. But my first joke was still not that great. But it was the first time that I understood joke structure. Mm-hmm. I was like, "Oh, that's what that is. Okay, that's a misdirect. Okay." So my first joke was, at the time, I was a web developer, mm-hmm. and my first joke was. I am a queer website designer, and people would laugh just at the word queer in general. And then I'd say, you know, my parents have come a long way in accepting my being a web designer. And so the misdirect was like when that dawned on me that like you could get a laugh, yeah. on something like that. I was like, oh, that's amazing. So that was my first joke ever where I understood joke structure.
I thought you were going to say you only designed queer websites.
well, actually, I did none whatsoever. It was so that class. So this guy sent me a postcard, and he's now a good friend of mine today, mm-hmm. and still keep in touch with him. And I feel like in some ways, you know. Not as a sort of bragging point, but like as his prize student, mm-hmm. like sometimes because what he taught me, I've taken it and run with it as far, and I'm still running.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful for what he taught me. And actually, being a website designer, being a web developer actually afforded me to be able to travel to wherever I wanted to go. So I could move to New York or LA and still do web development and work from home or work from a home office and still pursue my comedy career. And so those two things weirdly went really well together.
Was that class sort of your first foray into, you know, quote unquote, professional comedy?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I have to give him a shout out. His name is Tim Farrell. And he's a Maine guy who lived in New York for years, but he moved back to Maine and started offering this writing class at the local comedy club. And he really changed my life. I know we joke about it because he sent me a postcard, a black and white postcard to my office. And I don't know why. He said he randomly picked personal, personal addresses and business addresses. And he picked my address. Don't know how. Yeah. I don't know if it was from like the Chamber of Commerce or whatever. But that postcard sat on my desk in my office in downtown Portland, Maine for probably a couple weeks, maybe 3 weeks before I called him. And of course, I'm like such a procrastinator that I called him like 2 days before this workshop started. Mm-hmm. And I said, and it's such a salesman thing to do. I said, hey, do you have any spots left? And as a salesman, he was like, I got one left. You know, I was like, I'll take it. And he just hooked me into this art that I didn't know that since I was very, very little. There was a big chunk of my life in between being a little artist trying to write jokes about, you know, Bobby Orr to, you know, 15 years ago when I got this postcard. And he just plugged me into something that I didn't know I was missing. And when I got it, I was like, oh shit, this is it.
Yeah. You woke up to this realization of like what you could do.
Yeah. I mean, much in the way that, you know, people are looking for what they're meant to do, looking for their art, looking for their career, looking for whatever it is that they're most interested in that makes them wake up in the morning without an alarm clock. This, you know, actually starting my web development company was definitely one of those things for many years. I did that for many, many years. And I was so excited about this, you know, new technology. I started doing websites in 1996, by the way, which they were horrible. It was like picture text, and anything over like 15K. And it was like on a dial up and it was just horrible. It took forever. And so that was exciting to me. It was like this new thing that was happening that I was trying to convince people that it was going to be a really cool, big thing, this interweb thing. And most of the people didn't believe me in 1996. But it woke me up every day without an alarm clock. And I went to work every day and I tried to sell web pages, and I did, and did really well with it. But this new stand-up comedy thing gave me that same electricity, gave me that same thing in the morning. And I've been chasing it since. So 4 years into my career of doing stand-up, I was working regionally. I would go to Boston, occasionally further than that, maybe New York for like a guest set, and like travel, you know, drive 6 hours to do 10 minutes for no money, like because I loved it so much. And that's every comic story who's doing this and doing well at it, even if they're not doing well and they're in the beginning and they're like trying to get better, that's every comic story. You will drive anywhere for that 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And so I chased it. And 4 years in, I was like, I want to move. I want to pursue this. And it was either New York or LA. And honestly, the only thing that tipped the scales to LA for me at the time was the temperatures. I had grown up in Maine my whole life, and I was absolutely sick of the cold. And I was like, you know what? I need to go where it's warm. Yeah. And meant to be. I had a friend out here, and I called her. I hadn't talked to her in a long time. I knew her from Maine. She'd moved out here. And I said, you know, do you know anybody's looking for a roommate? And she said, oh, let me ask around and I'll get back to you. She calls me back like a month later. And she said, I am. I said, awesome. $600, everything included. And I've lived in the Valley ever since.
Yeah.
So I've been out here for 10 years, and which seems to be kind of, I don't know if other comics and other artists here in LA seems to be like the magic number of when stuff starts to really happen. If you really stay persistent and you really hang in there, like around this time, you know, if you get to do some other stuff, you get to do some acting, you get to do some writing, you get to do, and people, I think, start to recognize you a little bit. And so that's pretty much what happened for me and where I sort of transitioned into also being an actor.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting, circling back a little bit, my story, you know, I did music and then I did design and website design too on the side because it's a great supplement that you could do anywhere.
Absolutely.
And I think with all these things, there's this sort of creative, you know, to be poetic storytelling aspect in a lot of these artistic pursuits and stuff like that. And it's so interesting in my life meeting people who have maybe started out on one path thinking this was the fulfillment of that calling, that desire, that wish, but then realizing as you experience more, as you see more, as you try different things, that it's as great as this is, there's something else. There's that, like you said, that electricity that you're still chasing after.
Well, and it takes this willingness, right, to be able to pivot and not to think that you are one thing your whole life, and to this flexibility and acceptance that, you know what, the universe also wants you over here doing this other thing. And that, and you can push for all the things that you want, but you have to also be willing to be pushed in the direction you're supposed to go in. And sometimes it's not the one that you thought.
And ending isn't necessarily failure because it enables you to do something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Else.
You know what? I don't even believe, you know, a lot of people are like, I don't believe in failure. I really don't. Like, there's no such thing.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, and there's no such thing as no. That's the other thing is that people think that if they don't get an audition, they've been told no. And the truth is, why would you want to be part of something you weren't meant to be part of?
Exactly.
Imagine crashing a party you weren't invited to and how uncomfortable that is. Like someone says, hey, there's a party over there. Yeah, well, do you have an invite? No, you don't. And you don't have an invite. Like how just weird is that going to be? So I just think it's a pivot to a yes in another direction. You're not meant to be part of that party. You're meant to be part of another one. And it's in the pipeline. It's on the way to you. It's something that I definitely believe. So I don't believe in failure and I don't believe in no. I believe in, there's a yes someplace else and that's where I'm supposed to be. And that's where I'm headed.
I mean, have you felt that way most of your life or were there things that really?
Always.
That's incredible.
annoyingly so. And as a kid, I've always had the sensation that I was going to win the lottery. Like whether it be the real lottery or whether it be life's lottery.
Yeah.
And I've always felt like everything that's ever happened to me was a gift, like this massive, awesome. I'm so annoying about it, though, because I have friends who like have, you know, depressive disorders and they're like, you're an asshole. You know, like, you know, I actually one of my friends said to me sometimes, you know, a comic friend of mine said to me once. She said, you know, I have to admit, sometimes I actually think about committing suicide. And I said, well, listen, I said, if you really feel like that's what you're supposed to do, then that's what you're supposed to do. Like, and she was like, are you really convincing me that, like in a positive way that I'm supposed to commit suicide? I said, no, I'm saying that no matter what it is that you want for yourself, no matter what that is, I will support you in it. And I said, it may not be everybody's solution, but it is a solution. And I don't want you to do that. Selfishly, I want you here. I love you. I want you in my life. I don't want to spend, you know, my life not having you around and joking around with you, spending time with you, traveling with you, having fun with you, writing material with you. And I want that. But I also, if you are absolutely miserable, then I don't want you to be miserable anymore. So like, and she was like, I can't believe that you're putting some sort of positive spin on me taking my own life. And I said, you know, I know it sounds like that, but like, really, like, I know, I don't know. I'm kind of getting off track here.
No, it's
anyway.
I love it. It's like, have you ever read Viktor Frankl?
I haven't.
Man's Search for Meaning. He was
I did a really bad job here explaining who Viktor Frankl is. Frankl was a psychologist who was imprisoned in some of the concentration camps, and he wrote a book, Man's Search for Meaning, which was originally titled Saying Yes to Life in Spite of Everything, or From Death Camp to Existentialism. And arguably, one of his main points was that even in the most painful and disturbed and dehumanizing situations, that life still has potential meaning, and therefore even suffering is meaningful.
Like, view the negative parts of your life in a positive. And it sounds like that's a character trait that you have.
Yeah, and I'm always flipping the narrative.
Yeah.
No matter what anybody tells me, I can take anything and flip it, and it bugs the shit out of people. It really does. People really, especially people who don't have whatever that, I don't know if it's a gene or if it's an outlook or if it's just an outlook or an attitude, but if you don't have that, it's annoying.
Well, I imagine, especially in comedy too, where there's almost the stereotype of like the, you know, dark, demented, you know, person who comes into comedy.
Yeah, I don't believe in that archetype either. It's, you know, yes, that exists, but it is not the only thing that exists. You don't have to be depressed to be funny. You don't have to be, an active addict and suicidal to have a successful career in the comedy world. You don't. I mean, that's a weird, and I think that some people are attached to that identity, as a thing.
Overly romanticize it.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. I'm completely inverse.
No, I feel the same way. But you definitely, at least I've experienced a great number of people who, more people believe that to be true than not. And it's always interesting. Like you said, it's annoying sometimes your positive outlook. I jokingly say I'm annoyingly optimistic. Like, and it's that sort of same thing. Like, where it's the shittiest situation. Like, we're lost, running out of gas. I'm like, it's an adventure. Yeah, like, we get a camp in
absolutely.
This cool place.
Absolutely. I feel the same way. Like, there's a reason why. Oh, I'm supposed to get off this exit and do something else
now. And it doesn't necessarily, like, I'm not trying to say, like, there aren't hard parts in life and there isn't pain and there isn't. You know,
absolutely.
I'm not trying to belittle that either, you know, but it's just like, I can't change the fact that we're lost and out of gas.
But even in the moments of like really difficult moments for me, I am grateful to actually be able to have feelings about really hard stuff.
Yeah.
So when other people want to avoid it, like, I'm definitely like, why? Let's just do this. Let's walk through it. It's much easier.
I just told my mom, you need to cry more. She's always just like bottling it up.
Yeah. I mean, think about all the energy it takes to avoid and want to pluck yourself out of something and be lifted over it.
Yeah.
You know, through, let's even use drugs and alcohol as a example. By the way, which never actually works. Mm-hmm. You're never plucked out of and lifted up and over a situation through drugs and alcohol. It's a myth.
Yeah.
You're still in it. You're still actually behind the mountain. You just have to climb it. And so, I don't know. There's, for me, I find value in even in the pain.
Yeah.
Like where people might want to avoid. Here's the thing is that it's a myth that anybody's avoiding anything anyway. But I guess that's just my annoying, optimistic, and open sort of openness that I just think that, that's actually good. That probably one of the most difficult times for me was after I realized that I was transgender. I knew for certain that I wanted chest surgery. Mm-hmm. And it was very expensive at the time, and insurance didn't cover it. It now covers it in the state of California. But I thought, how am I ever going to save? As a comic and as someone who's now a comic, but supplementing my income with web development, which I'm traveling all the time, but I'm still not quite, making enough to put in the bank. Yeah. How do I save that money in order to get what I need in order to feel better in my head? And it was probably, and I don't want to say it was a dark time, but it was definitely a really difficult time thinking financially, how am I ever going to have this thing that I know that I need in order to move forward in a way that I can live a happier life? So, but that struggle was really important because I can't imagine now, like, just having the money to be able to do whatever I want, whenever I want. There's value in that struggle.
Yeah.
There's value in having those feelings. And also there's value in the sadness, there's value in the pain, but there's also value in figuring out how I'm going to get what I need and being resourceful and saving and hustling. I mean, all of those are really valuable skills. So when you are in a dark place, for me, or hard or dark or sad or painful, you know, to be able to access to like access those places, which I know that that is physically impossible for a lot of people, but I find value in it.
I like the word value there, because I think maybe a younger or a lesser version of myself could hear stories like that, that you tell or that I've experienced, and think like that pain and that struggle is necessary. But what I think I hear you saying is like, no, like it's not necessary. Like you don't need that to become who you are, but that also doesn't mean that these different parts don't have value. I like that word value. I think that's a better way of explaining it.
I mean, there's value in everything.
Yeah.
You know, when you run out of gas in your car and you have to roll off the exit and ask for help, that's a valuable lesson to ask people you don't know for help. It's a really vulnerable place to be. Mm-hmm.
How does this sort of viewing the value in everything, this optimism, et cetera, inform your comedy?
Sometimes it's also annoying to people when I'm on stage. I think what happens is that it makes me want to write in a way that makes everybody feel included.
Mm.
Trans, non-trans, like people say to me, you know, do you feel like you're pigeonholing yourself as a trans comic? And I'm not a trans comic. I'm a comic who is trans, but I talk a lot about trans, my process of transitioning and trans people and my feelings and the effects of testosterone. And people ask me if I've sort of pigeonholed myself as that kind of comic and as an identity comic. And the truth is everybody's an identity comic.
Yeah.
People find a through line in their life that they find most important, that they want to sort of get across to people their message, whatever that is. The insanity of things or the darkness of things, the ordinary of everything. You know, Jerry Seinfeld talks about nothing.
Yeah.
I talk about trans stuff. What is your through line in your life?
Meaningful, matterful, valuable, whatever that catch-all word is.
Yeah. So if you were to give a TED talk about the one thing that you seem to be trying to tell everybody throughout your whole life, what would it be?
The wonder of the mundane.
Okay. So that to me is what your identity ends up being about on stage, usually. And, so I find that I'm trying to write about things in a way that is accessible to everybody. And that is, whether people realize it or not, and most do, is that it's in a really positive spin, that I'm not a self-hating, trans person. I'm really happy. Here's some funny things that have happened along the way. And turns out, guess what? All of you can relate to it.
Yeah.
And I've had guys who are non-trans guys, non-trans women come up to me after shows and say, oh my God, I could totally relate to what you were saying. You made me laugh so hard. And now I have this new frame of reference for what trans people are really like. And they're actually not that different than what you, me. I'm like, yes, that is absolutely true. So my through line is our separateness is an illusion. That's my through line through everything. And my mother's in her 70s, okay? Now, she is someone who, I'm not sure what it is about women of that age. They find it comfortable to wear underwear that comes up to, well, about fucking here. What is that? And they're like that silky, soft material. You know what I'm talking about? Have you ever accidentally been doing laundry at your parents' house? Like, I was doing laundry at my parents' house. I was home to visit, and I had to do some laundry, and I was folding some of my mother's delicates. I don't even know if you can call them that. And I had one of those. I lost myself for just a second because it was so soft. It was like the top of the blanket, your baby blanket, that kind of soft. And I just had that moment of like, oh my God, that's so, and I almost... I don't know, what they come up to here, what do you do with the boobs? I don't know. Just like, is it a onesie? You just put the boobs in there? I don't know. She's awesome though. She by accident and not maliciously, sometimes calls me by my birth name, which is fine. She's grandfathered. It's fine. I don't care. You know, she's one of those people. She gave me my name. It's not malicious. It's really not. She's not misgendering me. She's not trying to be mean or anything like that. She just forgets sometimes. She's 77. So sometimes we're out in public. We were at a store. This happened. We were at a store, and I was down the aisle. She was at the register, and she's like, "Janet, come here." And I come running up. And I'm like, "Yeah, Mom." And I saw what happened. The woman at the register was like, "What?" And I realized what happened. And I said, "Mom, you got to stop talking like that or they're going to put you in a home."
I tell jokes about how I feel weird about the hair on my ass. You know, everybody has hair on their ass. Some is peach fuzz. Some is like really, you know, thick. You know, how do I talk about that as a guy, as a trans guy, as a person who feels awkward about their body at times, mm-hmm. and who hasn't felt awkward in their body?
Yeah.
Who hasn't?
Everyone.
So how do I make that accessible? Because even if it's a woman who doesn't necessarily have a hairy ass, which some do, I mean, you know, this is a fact. Everybody yeah. has a layer of fuzz, and the thickness and the color, it all varies.
Let's go into this more.
Yeah.
In your studies, what have you found?
But and if not, then if they can't see their own, because who really looks at their own ass hair except for me?
Because you're doing the research.
But, you know, they either have been partnered with somebody who has or has, you know, been in there. I don't know. Just everybody, this is accessible. They're yeah. talking about butt hair.
We had a Utkarsh Ambukar on the show earlier. He's a rapper and a freestyle guy and an actor. And he was talking about the most powerful phrase you can say is "me too." And how, you know, we all can relate at least somewhat with everyone.
Absolutely. When I first met my first trans guy, I think I was 28. I was at this like public... they called it a public forum where they had invited one of my favorite authors to come speak. And their name is Les Feinberg, and Les has since passed away. But I remember going to this event, and the guy who introduced Les was a local guy who shared maybe 5 minutes of his story that he was a trans man. And, you know, in this moment of me seeing myself for the very first time in somebody else like that, was so powerful. I started sobbing and I just kept saying, "That's me. Yeah. That's me. That's me." That identification, "me too, that's me," is so powerful. It's so powerful. And it's life-changing. It and also can be life-saving mm-hmm. for people out there who think that they are the only one, who think that they're alone on the planet with how many trillion people that we have, but they're the only one that feels the way that they do or is experiencing what they're experiencing. It can be life-saving. Someone can go, oh my God, I'm not the only one. I'm not
Which
the only one.
Goes a little bit back to what you're saying about having the labels.
Yeah.
Is like having a word to describe it. Yeah. I know when I get anxious about what I have to do like this month, this year, whatever, just like writing a list of sort of what do I need to do, like instantly just calms me down because it's like there's a word for it. I can see it. It's represented.
Yeah. For the longest time, I actually am an identity and a word collector. I collect all words and identities, names that I feel good in my throat when I say them, mm-hmm. or that feel good in my head when somebody else says them about me, or something that like I just connect with. Anything that I say, "me too,"
yeah.
that he's saying. I have so many, and I keep adding to them.
Yeah.
And I think no one is, I don't think anyone should limit themselves to simply one thing.
Mm-hmm. We're a living thing. We're always growing.
Yeah, absolutely. How boring. You know, someone said to me, they're like, "Okay, so you were a lesbian for how long?" I'm like, "Well, I don't know if I was a lesbian, but okay. Oh, I came out when I was 19, said that I like girls." But I also felt like there was something still sort of nagging at me, tapping me on the shoulder, going, "Psst, you know, hey, there's something else you haven't figured out yet."
And I feel like that once I stumbled upon this and met that other trans guy and thought, me too, I still am not done. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not fully cooked yet as a human. Like, I want to keep going. I want to keep expanding. And that's the thing that, you know, just because you figured that thing out about yourself, you're not done. Like, you have many years ahead of you to figure out more things. Relationship styles, political identities, sexual identities, personal identities, what kind of person you are.
On a lesser thing, like we were talking about earlier, but careers too.
Absolutely.
You know, just changing and collecting as well too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had a great role model when I was a kid, my Aunt Judy. I remember I was probably in my early 20s and I was kind of a little panicky about the pressure about what I was supposed to do with my life. And I was like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with my life. And she was probably like 45 at the time. She said, honey, she's like, I have done like 10 or 20 things in my life. She's like, I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. And she's done a million things. She's been a Montessori school teacher. She owned a Montessori school. She is now teaches yoga in French to toddlers. She has had an antique store that she dealt antiques. She has, I mean, she's done, I could go on. But that was such a powerful statement for me at that time. Like, oh yeah, like this is something that, and although my parents kind of, you know, stuck very much to, you know, their careers throughout their lives. And my dad was a career pharmacist for his whole life, owned a pharmacy, sold it, went to work for another private pharmacy. My mother worked in medical field and office administration, managing medical offices, and, you know, did what they had to do in order to raise us. And the pressure, I can't imagine. I still talk to them. I nag them because I'm looking for like Christmas gifts to try to like fulfill their lifelong dreams of whatever. But I remember asking my dad, I'm like, what did you want to do before you were a pharmacist? And he said, I wanted to be a pilot. I got him pilot lessons for... Wow. And he goes, well, it figured out that, I get air sickness, so that wouldn't have worked out anyway, but he went and did this thing. He went for like three times, had to wear that like little pressure bracelet in order to get on the plane and go do this thing. But at least he now knows that, you know, it's not a thing that he will always question if he could have done or whatever. I think he's now like, no, check, you know?
Yeah.
And my mother wanted to go to RISD and wanted to be an artist, wanted to be, we are not these one trick ponies. We are not these, we are so much more than what our careers are. And I actually think that we're artists first and that we just have to do, like what my friend, do you know who Sarah Benincasa is?
Yeah, just the name only.
She's a great writer. She's written several books, but she wrote this really great blog, which I think has now been turned into a book called Real Artists Have Day Jobs.
Yes.
And basically, like, I think we're artists first and that we have to do something to support that art. And a lot of people feel very upset with that idea. Like, no, I'm an artist. Only an artist. And, you know, it would be ideal to be simply an artist and to be paid to do that art. That would be great. And that's ideal, of course. But in when you can't do that, like, you might have to build some web pages, you know, you might have to, whatever that is.
And it gives you great opportunities to have those moments where you can connect and say, you know, we're more similar than you think.
Yeah, absolutely. And my parents, though, were of that generation. They're like, no, you have to do this one thing. We are not artists first. We do that in our spare time, but we don't even have spare time because we have three kids to raise. So I think about the generation after theirs, my generation and after. I think that we are more of this mindset that we're artists first, which is really, really cool to see.
Well, it's so interesting just hearing. I mean, there's an obvious, you know, through line from kitchen door, what was it, refrigerator door, Bobby Orr jokes, to web design, to where you are today, of this sort of, I mean, I think you said pivot, but in the most positive sense of the word. I don't know if that has a connotation of like you know, you can't stand still, so you're always changing. But just sort of being open, I think you said too, openness.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
I took this acting class with someone here in town. Her name is Joan Scheckel. And I did this acting workshop in order to get the part that I got on Transparent. I did it with the cast of Transparent. And one of the things that they went around and asked before, they said, tell us what you think your most distinctive quality is since birth. Kind of like, how were you, when you came out, what would you say the thing is that you have always been? Mm-hmm. And I said optimistic, and she said, you mean open? And I said, yes. And it's true. I mean, I really feel like that has been, my through line, you know, my through line of who I am, but my message to other people is in part, you can be this way too.
Yeah.
And we are all the same. We are all artists. We are all creatures that should be expanding. We are all connected. I don't know.
What's next for you?
In career or art or however I want to answer that, I just filmed my first 1-hour special. And so I'm super excited about that. That's something to me that I'm kind of in awe that I got to do it, that someone was interested. It's funny because I could tell you maybe 5 years ago, I thought that I was ready. Mm-hmm. But the truth is you have to wait for the universe to be ready. You can go, I've been ready for this for, you know, since the day I was born, or I've been doing stand-up for however long and I should be doing blah, blah, blah. I didn't have that. I might have thought maybe 5 years ago, why is nobody sort of, you know, taking notice of this different take on dick jokes that I have? Why has nobody, you know? And truthfully, I think that there had to be an elevation of the trans subject matter in order for everybody to sort of be ready for it. Like, I might have been ready, but maybe the world wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's been really great to feel that presence of the conversation elevated enough that I could do a 1-hour special and have, you know, someone like CISO buy it and want to air it. So I'm really excited about that too.
Where can people find you?
At my newly designed website that I did the other night, ianharvey.com, and Harvey is spelled H-A-R-V-I-E.
And be sure to check out his special on CISO called
May the Best Cock Win.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Awesome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the paper for the gum.
the very literally the least of it.
It's literally...
I mean, I guess I could have given you a smaller piece.
That would have been the very least. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. You got more.
Thank you so much for listening this week. Hope you're having a great holiday season. If you'd like to know more about our show, you can always follow us on Twitter at CISO Show. That's S-E-E-S-O Show. And if you feel like it, you can always tell a friend about our show as well. Again, thank you so much and take care.